From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Chris Layman sees a clear connection between the modern Tea Party and Mormonism's earliest leaders. He says both see and saw themselves as a beleaguered and persecuted faith now encircled by an implacably hostile federal state. This sense of persecution and embattled faith, Layman says, is Mormonism's gift to the conservative movement. But also, he says, the faith has given the Republican Party its economic model. In an essay for Harper's Magazine, Layman argues this Mormon model, prudence, self-reliance, and mistrust of government, is shaping the Republican Party. Today in the program, Layman will join us to explain the history of this model and the remarkable influence it's having on American politics. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In an essay for Harper's Magazine, the journalist Christopher Layman makes note of what has become the Mormon moment in popular culture. Two Mormon presidential candidates, Mormon stories and themes playing out on stage and television. But there's another part of Mormon belief that he says isn't getting as much attention, but he argues has become a key feature in American political life. It's the Mormon economic model. Not just the structure of it, but the ideas. Prudent self-reliance, a mistrust of government. He says this Mormon way of thinking is actually shaping the Republican Party. Today in the program, Chris Layman is joining us to talk about the ideas in his piece. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Chris Layman is a journalist and a writer. He's co-editor of Book Forum magazine, the author of the book Rich People Things. His work has appeared in The Atlantic and Slate.com, The Washington Post, among others. His article, Pennies from Heaven, How Mormon Economics Shape the GOP, is the cover story of the October issue of Harper's. And today in the program, Layman is joining us from the studios of Sirius XM in Washington, D.C. And Chris Layman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Good morning. Good morning. It's morning there, right?
It's morning there. Here.
Yes,
yeah.
Good.
I guess I wanted to start with, you talk about how it's kind of puzzling that most people haven't made this this connection. But, I mean, you say that, you know, there's this Mormon moment in popular culture, but no one is quite right. Seeing the influence of the economic model in American politics, particularly conservative American politics. Why do you figure that is?
Well, I think, you know, it's for a number of reasons. As you and your listeners well know, there's been this longstanding dynamic of, you know, the Mormon faith being viewed somewhat suspiciously by the mainline Protestant world. And so I think we interpret that relationship in terms of the mainstream, i.e., you know, traditional Protestant denominations and Mormons, you know, wrestling with the issue. And Protestants also wrestling with the issue of how Mormonism fits into the American religious civic culture. So I think it's understood chiefly as a cultural question.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think as your listeners probably also know, there is a pronounced kind of political philosophy that comes with Mormon faith. It has to do with, you know, the preeminence of the family, the virtues of thrift and hard work, a certain distrust of the federal state, a horror of debt, an attraction to sound money.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of these things you can see very prominently right now in the Republican political debate, not merely because there are two Mormon candidates in the field, but because there is this sort of, you know, and I'm not posing necessarily a causal relationship here, but there is this convergence of ideas between, you know, conservative economic thought and, you know, the Mormon legacy in these issues.
I guess the question which we'll sort of work through is, so is it the Mormon model itself or are these just the ideas that are built into the Mormon model? That is it actually a Mormon influence?
Yeah, I think, you know, one can say it's not necessarily an either-or proposition,
sure,
right?
Sure.
You know, I think, you know, there's been a longstanding, you know, alliance in conservative politics between Mormons and the sort of Republican establishment. I think it was the Reagan White House still holds the record for the highest number of Mormon appointees. Obviously, both, well, Mitt Romney comes from a, you know, he's a second generation Mormon leader in the Republican Party. There, you know, there is, again, I see it as kind of a, you know, two streams kind of converging, right? That, you know, Mormon principles of economic self-organization have obviously been critical in, you know, the consolidation of the faith institutionally, the founding of Utah, and, you know, the broader philosophy of how heads of households should conduct themselves in matters of debt and how, by extension, government should function.
Well, you mentioned Reagan there, which is, I guess, a way of explaining. But you talk about, for example, how, aside from the economic model, which we're going to get to here in a moment, but you say the church's, one of its real gifts to the right has been this sense of persecution and embattled faith. And that seems to, those seem to be the elements that really fueled the conservative revolution under Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, the sort of the moment when the Reagan coalition really was able to be a successful national movement was basically when the business establishment that traditionally led the Republican Party joined forces with the evangelical right. The evangelical right became a very potent force, as we all know, in American politics in the late 1970s. And, you know, Mormons were a big part of that process because, again, in cultural terms, there's a great deal of affinity there, despite the, you know, kind of a history of antagonism between mainline American Protestant denominations and the Mormon faith. There's, you know, obviously family values type issues, you know, well, family values type issues, I guess is chiefly what I'm saying. And that proved a critical fulcrum in, you know, bringing off this alliance. And that's why, you know, in California, before he ran for president, Reagan had a number of people, including John Huntsman's father, you know, and from the Mormon faith, strategizing and building out his you know, effort to win election as president.
You write in the article, you talk about how this business side, this economic model of Mormonism is really an important way in which the faith has come into the American mainstream. But what is it? How do we describe it? You identify it in the piece as a kind of ethos of accumulation.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's a tendency to, you know, in general, we think of the economic side of religious life as either something we don't really want to talk about much or else something that's contained in these big theoretical ideas. Like, you know, Max Weber had the famous thesis about the Protestant ethic and how it was, you know, crucial to, you know, the rise of capitalism.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me about Mormonism is the Protestant ethic. I don't want to go into a big Max Weber sidebar here, but you know, what fuels the Protestant ethic, according to Weber, is, you know, Protestants have this tremendous ambivalence about wealth. They're making money, but they feel kind of like, is this going to get me into heaven? Am I going to be able to, you know, what is the relationship between my worldly endeavors and my salvation?
Right.
And that problem was basically solved, Weber says, by the idea of a divine calling, a vocation that, you know, basically channels all that anxiety. Now, what's interesting to me about Mormonism, you read the Book of Mormon, there is almost no ambivalence about accumulating wealth. Mm. Accumulating wealth is a very straightforward sign of divine blessings. It's one of the most, after, you know, the expression, and so it came to pass, one of the most frequently repeated phrases in the Book of Mormon is some variation of observe my word and honor, this is the voice of God, obviously.
Sure.
Honor my dictates and you will be rewarded with prosperity. You will be given land. You will be given wealth. There are a couple of instances where you know, people in the Book of Mormon kind of overstep the bounds and pursue wealth for the sake of vanity and you know, self-regard, but in general, and I think this all has to do with the history of the church being, you know, a group of persecuted exiles within the American continent, you know, the need for land and stable wealth became unbelievably crucial to the institutional life of the church.
You write in the article, this queasy business about the camel going through the needle's eye before a rich man enters the kingdom of heaven is not for Mormons. So they make a connect. They don't feel ambivalent about it. Prosperity comes from obedience to God.
Well, I'm going by the Book of Mormon chiefly sure. there. Obviously, Mormonism has evolved in the past century and a half, and there are plenty of, you know, Mormons who do preach, you know, in a different register about questions of wealth and its distribution. But by and large, yeah, there isn't the scriptural kind of basis for Mormons to feel, you know, like there's a conflict there between what, you know, their worldly possessions and their divine destiny.
You talk about, I want to sort of explore this a little bit more. One of the people you sure. spoke with was Mark Skousen. He's mm-hmm. the nephew of the, some may know, the Mormon sort of ultra-conservative Cleon Skousen. Yeah, right. He calls Mormonism the Protestant ethic on steroids.
Right.
And he's very much an Orthodox Mormon. And he explains this concept to you. And he said that the Mormon spin on the prosperity gospel, which is sort of another way of saying all of this, I guess,
right.
as similar to the kinds of stories that appear in the – are similar to the kinds of stories that appear in the Old Testament in the Bible in the sense that
right.
it's this cycle. You get close to God. You prosper. You fall away, you right. don't. But the prosperity right. seems to and, be the crucial point, right?
Yeah, and Mark likens it to the business cycle, which I thought was an astute kind of observation. The Old Testament is, you know, where you see, you know, this, you know, one of the main, you know, narrative arcs in the Old Testament is God is promising land and well-being to the, you know, the Jewish people if they will, you know, focus on his word and honor his authority. And that is very, very much, it's a very strong affinity with the language and rhetoric in the Book of Mormon.
It's interesting how Skousen and I guess many others say that their view of economics, and his is this, you know, pretty conservative, anti-Keynesian, you know, supply-side view of economics, how this came from his sense of his faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was struck by that as well. He described, you know, being an undergraduate economics student and coming across what was then the kind of standard Paul Samuelson textbook, you know, which is Keynesian and sort of just explains how public debt can work in a stimulative fashion under, you know, conditions of economic distress. And Mark, you know, who I would say he would probably chafe at being described as a conservative or a supply-sider. I think he's a classical libertarian.
Libertarian, yeah.
He's an Austrian kind of economic thinker. But, you know, he said, yeah, instinctively, being raised Mormon, you see the idea that debt can be, you know, in certain circumstances, virtuous. That made absolutely no sense to him. It was sort of a moral issue for him. And I think, you know, I think that's true for a lot of Mormons who are, especially in the economic profession, there's a very pronounced tendency to, again, it's not ideological per se, but I do think it comes from, you know, this very strong abiding sense that debt is wrong. And again, that the fascinating thing to me is that also follows the early history of the church. You know, one of the you know, I think Joseph Smith is the only founder of a major religion who tried to start his own bank in Kirtland, Ohio. And the bank, it's striking how similar that episode was, because there was a big 1830s real estate boom in that part of Ohio. And Smith wound up, you know, by some accounts, well, objectively, the bank was far overextended, yeah. and there were no underlying assets to support the notes at issue. So I think this might sound a little familiar to your listeners. Mm-hmm. This is kind of what's happened in the American economy over the last 4 years or so, and from that experience, I think, you know, and Joseph Smith also had an earlier career as a money digger in upstate New York before the Book of Mormon was published. And, you know, I think that background and the experience in Kirtland combined to make both him personally and the faith more generally very, very distrustful of anything that was not hard money, that was not hard real estate, that was not kind of a tangible asset. And Dad is very much not that, right? So yeah.
I was just going to say, a good part of the article talks about the origins of all of this. And you go back to Joseph Smith trace what you describe as this kind of almost lifelong obsession he has with attaining wealth and losing wealth. You quote the biographer Fawn Brody, who has this, I guess objectively to say, fairly critical biography of Smith. But she said he had a poor man's awe of gold and that it crept into his concept of heaven.
Yeah, and, you know, she does quote from Mormon scripture Joseph Smith had delivered visions of the afterlife that were very much, you know, all sort of ordinary substances transmuted into gold and precious metals. It's a very alchemical, I've never said that word out loud, but an alchemist-like, and there's actually another very, a very good book on the early origins of the Mormon church called Refiner's Fire by Brooke is his last name. I can't believe it. Robert Brooke, I believe. Anyway, it draws all these really powerful affinities between, what's this kind of underground tradition in Anglophile Protestantism, this attraction to alchemy and the idea of precious metals possessing kind of magical properties. And you know, the gold or the money digging tradition that Smith came out of, both, you know, spiritually and geographically in upstate New York, people would say these chests of gold would emerge out of the landscape and then vanish because there were, you know, spirits underneath were disturbed when people tried to retrieve them. And it's a very interesting, you know, one doesn't want to make too much of this, but, you know, it is not uncommon for, you know, precious metals throughout the alchemy tradition have been, you know, ascribed divine properties. And I think, you know, there is an element, you know, and again, one can get carried away, especially with the Glenn Beck side of, you know, marketing gold in a time of distress and all that. I don't want to draw too firm a line here, but it is, again, a suggestive background, and I think it is part of the heart, you know, and as you know, the state of Utah just recently passed a law endorsing the exchange of gold and silver in, merchandising outlets. So there, you know, there is a through line there that I think is interesting, and hard money is an emerging issue on the conservative wing of the Republican Party. Ron Paul obviously supports a return to the gold standard, and a lot of candidates right now in the early phase of the primary are making similar noises because there is a very pronounced strain within the Tea Party wing of the party that they don't want to alienate that supports some version of a return to the gold standard.
We should say it's John Brooke, by the way, Refiner's Fire.
Oh, thank you.
somebody else told me. So Chris Layman is with us. His article, Pennies from Heaven, How Mormon Economics Shaped the GOP, appears in the October issue of Harper's Magazine. You can find a link to it on our website, KUER.org. We'll get to some of your questions and calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about an essay written by the journalist Chris Layman for Harper's Magazine. It's the cover for the latest edition. It's an examination of the Mormon economic model. Layman argues that this model, this idea of self-reliance with a healthy dose of mistrust for debt and government, is shaping the Republican Party. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. www.radiowestham.org. Before we get to a few calls, Chris Lehman, I wanted to talk to you about another kind of intriguing part, for me anyway, of the piece, which you talk about Clayton Christensen. He's this professor at Harvard mm-hmm. Business School. He's this pretty high-profile economist, and he specializes in the study of disruptive innovation. And I wanted you to talk about that, because Christensen sees the Mormon Church as the quintessential disruption innovation, I guess.
Yeah. Professor Christensen studies chiefly how technology works to disrupt existing market structures, and how, you know, at times, people running traditional companies are caught flat-footed by, you know, a quantum leap forward in innovation and technology. And he sort of, you know, I just sort of asked him, how do you see the Mormon faith fitting into this model? And he said, well, you know, I think it's a classic illustration of what market disruption is. We are, you know, Mormons, you know, every other traditional faith kind of superimposes these clerical authorities, these, you know, kind of bureaucratic structures between the believer and their experience of religion or God. And Mormons don't do that. It's a very sort of
democratic, you know, almost
democratic. Yeah. With a small D, right. As opposed to, you know, top down, it's bottom up. And it's true that, you know, again, as your listeners well know, the structure of, you know, apart from the elders at the top of the church, you know, the way individual Mormon churches are organized, it's a lay preaching model, which is very much in the Protestant, you know, pure, you know, English Protestant tradition. And again, that's why, you know, I'm always a little suspicious of mainstream media narratives in the first place, and especially this whole business about Mormons being in or out of the mainstream. I think they've been in the mainstream for 150 years, and it's, you know, not really an issue. And the structure of the church is a perfect, you know, example of how, you know, and that's Professor Christensen's argument as well, how, you know, a logic within the broader world of Protestant faith gets sort of distilled and expressed really powerfully in the Mormon church.
While some have come to see Mormonism as, you know, somewhat strange because of its cosmology and some of its beliefs, it's not really a strange, obscure faith when you think about how influential many of its ideas have been in shaping America, and not just conservative America, but it seems like Protestantism throughout the country.
Yep. Yeah, and especially in the sphere of you know, business and economic thought, you know, there are many you know, the former CEO of JetBlue, the CEO of Dell Computers, obviously the Hilton Hotel chain, you know, the private sector is, you know, I haven't seen hard research on this, but anecdotally, you know, there is a very strong representation of Mormons at the highest levels of corporate leadership in America. And again, I think, you know, you can draw a pretty strong affinity there from the structure of the church. That's, you know, the church is one of the largest landholders in the United States. It is, you know, the individual denominations aside, it is, you know, one of the wealthiest religious institutions in the United States. And, you know, and this is actually why I think Mormonism captures both sides of the American experience. There is this democratic structure of worship, and there is also a very strong corporate principle of self-organization. And that's, you know, I'm fascinated, for instance, by how the two Mormon candidates, Romney and Huntsman, they're both second generation, you know, heirs to corporate fortunes. Yeah. And we haven't had, I guess, you know, Steve Forbes, who's sort of a protest candidate. But on the Republican side, you go back to Nelson Rockefeller and the I guess, 68, 64. Yeah. I don't even remember. But
and then Kennedy.
It's been a long time. Yeah, Kennedy for the Democrats. It's been a long time since there's been this, you know, these kind of silver spoon candidates on, especially on a, you know, a Republican presidential field that stresses a kind of cultural populism. And it's, at, as we saw in the last Romney candidacy, it can be an awkward fit in cultural terms. But oh, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think you meant the Marriott hotel chain, not the Hilton hotel chain.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
Obviously. 801-585.
John Brooke.
Right,
sorry.
Right. Let's go to the phones. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Mark is with us in Salt Lake. Mark, welcome.
Hi, thanks. What I wanted to point out that in the Book of Mormon, there's the cycles of prosperity and suffering are tied to wealth, and ultimately the people are destroyed because of their wealth. It's not immorality that destroyed the people in the Book of Mormon. It was because they had wealth and they withheld it from the poor. It was income disparity. And every time I talk, well, most of the time when I talk with my Mormon friends, what usually happens is they bend over backwards to defend people who've worked hard for wealth and condemn people who don't work hard enough, who get free, who are freeloaders, et cetera, even though they are such a minority in the community. And it's a strange kind of, like, we've got to do our best to defend wealthy people and apologize for them because they give lots of extra money, you know, to good causes, and they donate things. It's a strange kind of psychosis around it, you know, that ignores so many scriptural references, that condemns wealthy people and rarely justifies anything that they do. And
I wonder
if it's unique to Mormons.
Well, I think what's interesting, Chris Layman, about what Mark is saying is that what he's saying, and you hear this, I'm sure you've heard this in response to your piece, mm-hmm. It's not within Mormon doctrine. It's a misreading by the culture or certain Mormons or conservative Mormons of the actual doctrines of Mormonism. That's not what it's about.
Right.
It's something else. They're justifying, maybe, in some ways. Maybe is what Mark is getting at. You want to respond?
Yeah. I mean, I think in general terms, yeah, the Lamanites are no relation, are defeated, you know, in part because of, you know, an undue attraction to the you know, vain trappings of wealth. But I guess in my reading and in some others' reading, that is an individual flaw of character more than, you know, wealth being somehow, you know, a corrupting influence in and of itself. That is to say, the Lamanites were, you know, they fell away from the faith first and they started, you know, sinning and, you know, killing their rivals and, you know, the worship of pomp and wealth was part of that, you know, complex of bad behavior and vice. And there's a sense, again, in at least in the New Testament Protestant tradition, that wealth itself is an object of ambivalence or distrust. And there are just many, many, you know, especially the kind of exhortative passages in the Book of Mormon that come from God himself are, you know, almost never condemn, you know, worldly wealth as itself a source of corruption. Hmm. So I think, yeah, in general, the Book of Mormon does follow, again, what I would call a kind of New Testament narrative, as we were describing earlier, you know, the boom and bust cycle where, you know, the New World Hebrew tribes fall out of divine favor and suffer bad fortune, and then they recover and, you know, live right, and then they're rewarded, and they're often rewarded materially.
There's a response to your article in the church-owned Deseret News. Hal Boyd made a response to it. One of the things he says, your idea that Mormonism has this ethos of wealth accumulation, he says, is easy to disprove, he says. And you mentioned this scripture that you quote from. It's from the Book of Mormon. It's from a book called Jacob, the Book of Jacob. Think of your brethren like unto yourselves, be familiar with all, and free with your substance, that they may be rich like unto you. But this, Hal Boyd points out that, you know, the scripture after that is, but before you seek riches, seek the kingdom of God. That, in other words, maybe yours is mm-hmm. a simplistic reading of it, that in fact it's not about riches, it's about pride. It's about that's the bad thing. Look for God first. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I think I haven't read the rest of Mr. Boyd's piece, but it seems like it sounds to me like he's making the same point I was just now making,
yeah.
that, you know, yes, in your heart, you must worship God, and then the good things of the world will come to you, and you can, you know, and it is much like the prosperity gospel, a gospel of abundance. It is, you know, there's no question in my mind that, you know, the first half of that quote about, you know, be bountiful and generous with your wealth.
With your so wealth, and everyone else can be rich like you, right? So I guess the
problem
being...
the problem is, you know, it's very, very difficult to live in a modern economy, and you know, not everyone can be rich in a modern economy. So that,
well, and you point out that most Americans aren't. Most Mormons aren't affluent, aren't in that category of the rich. What do you make of that?
Well, it is an interesting, you know, faith truly does work in mysterious ways because, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, the Calvinists, you know, early Protestants that Max Weber describes, you know, were really freaked out about being wealthy, and they thought they were going to jeopardize their salvation by making money. And they hit upon a formula that just allowed them to make so much more money. they sort of worked out this ambivalence in you know, and that gave us the rise of modern capitalism.
Yeah.
So that's a great example of the law of unintended consequences in a certain
way. But you're saying Mormons never had that ambivalence in the first place. They didn't have to do too many gymnastics to get to that point of saying, you know, wealth is fine.
Yeah.
As long as it's
has a great deal to do, again, with the history of the church. I think, you know, if you're looking for a foothold in a culture that is, you know, in many instances out to kill you, it is very important to have a very stable footing, you know, your own holdings, your own wealth, something that, you know, the American government is going to take from you.
Let's go back to the phones. Mark, thanks, by the way. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Zach is with us in Springville. Zach, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
No, in relation to the caller's last comments, also, I feel like there's a really deep, deep tradition of almost socialism within the church. I mean, the references in the scriptures to wealth are very often about obtaining wealth for the sake of doing good, for the sake of helping others, for the sake of making people equal. And there are very specific, for example, like in 3 Nephi, there's this specific instance where they become corrupt because they start to set themselves above their brethren. They have, you know, nice things. And I feel like there's, Brigham Young even made comments to that regard that he feared sort of the wealth of the people would be the corrupting influence. And I feel as though, you know, you talk about this tie-in with conservative America and then Mormon faith, and I feel like that has happened in the last 30 or 40 years, largely to sort of the co-opting of the value set of, because those principles that you identify that Mormons espouse of distrust and of accumulating hard money and all those things, I think were always true. But I feel like that's been co-opted into the right, and instead of those things being directed at sort of communal well-being, they've been directed at personal accumulation of aggrandizement and wealth. And I was curious what your thoughts were about that perhaps what's happened is that Mormon ethic has sort of been co-opted into a much more capitalist sort of personal aggrandizement ethic that wasn't actually there in the first place.
Co-opted and distorted. Chris Layman, what do you think?
I think, you know, there's a lot to that. I think, you know, the Mormon scripture, like scriptures in all major religions, admits to varying interpretations, and I think as well that you know, again, going back to the early history of the church, Sidney Rigdon, who was Joseph Smith's top lieutenant throughout the, you know, early founding of the church was a socialist, yeah. And the church held all goods in common right up through, you know, and beyond, actually, when the Utah Territory was founded, and Brigham Young had a very, yeah, the Brigham Young moment is a really interesting, I mean, one can interpretations of Brigham Young are almost as legion as those of Joseph Smith. People have called him like everything from an authoritarian proto-fascist to a socialist, or I think what's to draw yet another analogy, I guess. I think there are interesting affinities between Mormonism and Zionism. What began as a secular socialist movement in the founding of modern Israel, and is they're both are kingdoms founded in the desert. Both hew to a obvious sort of Old Testament style approach to faith, and both have become engines of capitalist enterprise in an interesting way, and I do think, to answer your specific question, of the last 30 or 40 years, I think undeniably, a lot of the, institutional leadership of the church has found common cause with the aims of the conservative movement. And I think and you really don't have to look much further than, Mitt Romney's appeal on the presidential stump. It's all based on, I know how to fix the economy. I, created jobs in the private sector my entire career. That is a very, very powerful, the alliance between capitalist enterprise and Mormon belief is a very, very strong force in American life.
So you don't think it's a settled... This question of whether or not Brigham Young, ditched all the socialist beliefs of early Mormonism and created this massive, capitalistic empire, that's too simple-minded a way of reading it. He may have been able to adapt.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, all history is always evolving. And, Young was, he founded collectively held, farm and mercantile exchanges that still function in some form today. And again, the other analogy with Zionism is, I think Mormonism it in its history is a kind of economic nationalism. For many of the same reasons. You need a firm foundation of self-help and independence in financial and material terms to, protect yourself in what's a hostile mainstream culture.
You point out that the LDS Church, of course, runs a number of businesses you mentioned that has, extensive corporate investments, and all of these assets are not publicly disclosed, but there's some estimates of, church owning a $16 billion insurance company, $6 billion in stocks, you point out in the piece, $172 million in radio stations, more than 150 farms and ranches, believed to be the, among the largest landowners in the country. And I guess I wanted to put those numbers in perspective of other Protestant churches, which you do in the piece itself. And how significant is that? Other churches are not as engaged in commerce, at least it seems.
No, it's true. And their investment portfolios are mainly driven by things like, pension funds for their, clerical employees. And again, this is where I think the model of economic nationalism kind of applies. The Mormon Church clearly, and again, I'm not criticizing this. I think it makes total sense in terms of the church's history, understands that you need a very firm financial footing to survive, and it's also again going back to the ethos of individual believers, it's also why heads of households are told to lay in supplies of food that will last a year in the event of emergencies. It's very much the idea that you need to survive a very abundant perch in the world.
Chris Lehman is with us. He's the author of the book Rich People Things. His article, Pennies from Heaven, How Mormon Economics Shaped the GOP, is the cover story of the current Harper's Magazine. There's a link to it on our website at KUER.org. Zach, thanks very much. We'll get to more of your calls when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@KUER.org. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Chris Lehman. We're talking about his article, essay, that appears in the latest edition of it's the cover piece, in fact, of Harper's Magazine, Pennies from Heaven, How Mormon Economics Shaped the GOP. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back to the phones. Jane is with us in Orem, Utah. Jane, welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
It seems that in discussing this issue, it's important to separate the cultural and the doctrinal in the sense of the kind of Republican manifest destiny American LDS hybrid is this cultural perception of wealth, where on the other hand, the doctrinal perception that you gain prosperity to lift other people strictly, not to lift yourself, which is shown in how the church operates, where it doesn't operate and hold these things out of fear, but rather because it has a mission it perceives itself in needing to perform. And so it has assets to help in humanitarian funds, and it's there far longer than many organizations. It has assets to support a missionary program to build temples. And so rather than out of fear, the doctrinal base of being secure is to perform the mission it has, whereas I think the cultural perception, which is not completely lined up with the doctrine, kind of has taken on some of that manifest destiny American, you know, build up your wealth and make yourself prosperous. And I think there's a divide between the two that needs to be addressed.
Well, Chris Lehman, talk about that, because I have to say in almost all of the emails, and let me rattle them here, that we're getting related to this, many of them go to Jane's point, which is this idea that no, you're misreading Mormon doctrine. If you really look at Mormon doctrine, it's not about prosperity and riches. It's about pride. And in fact, when people get rich, they forget God. And what's happening with, I guess, Jane's point is that there's this cultural distortion of what Mormonism is really all about. But it seems to me the point of your article is no, sorry. I've looked at it. The Mormon doctrine is the thing that's contributing to this idea within the conservative movement and the Republican Party.
Well, again, I wouldn't put it that, you know, as I was saying earlier, I see this as a confluence rather than as a causal relationship. But the doctrinal versus the cultural point is important. And as your earlier caller was had noted, you know, there's been a noticeable sort of consolidation of a hard money distrust of debt ethos in Mormonism since, you know, the rise of the alliance with the religious right. I think there's very little question about that. I do think, you know, as I was saying earlier, like, yes, I have never pursued the argument that, you know, Mormons are, or the Mormon scripture divorces wealth from any moral scheme.
Sure.
I'm just saying that it's a noticeable departure from, you know, the traditional Protestant ethic as we see in the New Testament and Weber and R.H. Taney and all these other people who've studied it, that wealth itself is not a potential snare. As, you know, you were saying and several other callers have already noted, wealth becomes a problem when it's a reflection of pride, of spiritual, you know, putting the self before God. And yes, to, you know, I also note in the piece that there is a very strong ethos of self-help in the Mormon world. There's, obviously the church has a great missionizing program and a great social welfare program to help Mormons who fall on hard times. That is all undeniably true, and it has a relation to doctrine. But it's also true that, you know, Mormon scripture and the sort of, you know, the iteration of the Mormon faith we're seeing now, which is largely presented to the American public as a, you know, having really important economic lessons, is it's fairly what is the word? Conservatism is, or to call something conservative is to call it, like, I don't know, round. You know, I think we need to, like, be really careful about our language in all of these debates. And I do think that, you know, it is a frontier style, and, as I was saying earlier, an economic nationalist kind of style. And I think what you are, you know, seeing, especially around the issue of debt as it relates to modern conservative politics, is this amazing kind of, you know, belief in an almost, you know, mystical belief in the value of gold and precious metals. And, you know, all of these things are cultural features of the Mormon tradition, but they're also overtaking a great deal of the economic debate on the right. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, right down to issues like, you know, Social Security, of which, interestingly, Mitt Romney has emerged as a chief defender.
Isn't that interesting? I wanted to bring that up, actually.
Debate, yeah.
Yeah, because there's a section, and thanks, Jane, by the way, good job. Howard Ruff, this Mormon financial writer who emerges after he wrote this personal investment handbook in the 70s, which became incredibly popular. I mean, Ruff, you say in the piece, figured that any wealth that was, you know, socially created, as he put it, wasn't legitimate. And a lot has been said about Texas Governor Rick Perry describing Social Security as a Ponzi scheme. And, but it was Howard Ruff, it seems, who said it first, or was one of the first to think of it that way.
Yeah. Right. He used that. My jaw dropped when Perry said that. I was like, God, he must have read Howard Ruff.
So let's talk about how the current political battles reveal the influence of this Mormon economic model. Let's take, as you do in the piece, the example of the debt ceiling debate, which you say took on this kind of existential importance for the right.
Yeah, it became, you know, the debt ceiling had been raised, I think, 79 times previously in the Republic's history. It's you know, basically it's a reckoning with outstanding, you know, all the money under debate had already been spent. There was no real, you know, issue to be joined in terms of, yes, you can use it as leverage, as the right did for to exact future spending cuts. But, you know, the history of, you know, however you feel about the wisdom of raising the debt ceiling, it was a fairly routine bureaucratic procedure based on, you know, just looking at the books and realizing, you know, we had better make room for some more debt here.
Yeah.
And what happened in Washington this summer, and I'm right here watching it all, is there was this, you know, kind of, you know, fundamentalist, I shouldn't use that word in this context, but a very literal distrust of, you know, the idea that you can give any kind of leeway to the federal government to generate more debt. And, you know, one of the paradoxes of this is a great deal of the debt, that we're trying to service now comes from the two wars of a previous Republican administration waged.
Yeah.
And there, you know, there is that typical self-serving Washington thing where, you know, somehow, you know, the problems of an enormous federal government run by both parties become the what one party inherits when, you know, it's vulnerable. So, but I do think the larger question is, you know, there is this, you know, kind of naive transposition of the idea that, like, well, individual households can't afford to sustain debt, therefore the federal government, you know, shouldn't be held to any different standard. But, you know, the federal government is different. It does print money. It does, you know, use deficit spending to spend its way out of economic downturns. This, it is, it, you know, These are things that it can do and arguably need to do in certain circumstances. And to have that rigid idea of, you know, we need a virtuous government, you know, of the sort that the founders, you know, originally envisioned, the smallholder Jeffersonian ideal, that is just, you know, we have an economy that is far, far too large for that model to really, you know, for us to operate on a perpetually balanced budget. So
let me ask you this finally.
Sure.
Probably too complicated a question for the minute or so we have left. But this idea, it seems like you talk about the debate kind of brought to mind this prophecy that Joseph Smith used in that in the end days, you know, in the final days, mm-hmm. you know, the America is going to be in a disarray and this Constitution is going to hang by a thread. And you heard this kind of idea throughout the debate. That seems to be a pretty clear reflection of maybe at least part of the influence of Mormon rhetoric on American politics, do you think?
Well, there's always been a lot of millennial rhetoric, and I should, especially given all the emails you're getting, caution that, you know, the church does not necessarily regard this, what's known as a white horse prophecy, as part of established doctrine. It's sort of apocryphal, but still very influential. And you hear it, you know, Orrin Hatch has used it in public settings, and Glenn Beck seems to utter the phrase, "The Constitution is hanging by a thread," almost every other day. And I do, you know, there is a, you know, I would say, again, this is another case where Mormons are not that different from mainstream Protestants in America. You know, you can look back on, you know, any number of episodes in our history where millennial belief has, you know, been a powerful political force. And people, you know, that's true on in the Baptist world, in the Pentecostalist world today. You know, the Left Behind books are among, I think, the best-selling works of fiction in the world. And, you know, they're the works of a Pentecostal preacher. So apocalypticism is always going to be part of the American experience, I think.
Chris Layman, author of the book Pennies from Heaven, How Mormon Economics Shaped the GOP. Look for a link to it on our website. Chris, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.